Thanks for the invitation. It is really nice to be here. I have a long history with this room, and I appreciate the regular invitation I've been getting over the last several years to come here. It's become a habit to be invited, which is nice. I know that even if and when I give a terrible talk, the next year I will be invited again. To try to do a little better. So I've been feeling and thinking and wondering lately about suffering that seems to be in the world. And I'm sorry to say so, it seems unfortunate. It's such a lovely room, and it's a beautiful moment to be alive in. So I hate to bring in the specter, the shadow of the suffering of the world, but I've been feeling it, aware that there is my suffering, and there is the suffering of the great earth and all beings. And I remember that I took this vow to live for the benefit of all beings a while back, and that whenever it occurs to me, I renew this vow to live for the benefit of all beings, but I'm not sure quite how to do that in light of the deep and seemingly constant suffering of so many beings, the conceivable and inconceivable suffering. It's interesting how hard it is to just sit with that feeling. I already want to put some light, but it's, look at the flowers. So can I hold it for a minute at least without the but, you know, and just feel that the pain of the world, the cries of the world, as we say, Avalokiteshvara has the capacity, the strength of character to hold and to just sit there for a while with the cries of the world. So I've been thinking as I've been wondering how to live. I've been thinking about a story of something that happened, maybe a dream I had some time ago, and some of you in this room were in that dream. Liz may have been there, Kokyo may have been there. This was at Green Gulch Farm when I was a younger monk there, and I was working in the kitchen, and I really was into working in the kitchen in the correct and not the incorrect way. Which, if those of you who know Zen practice know that there's a correct and incorrect way to work in the kitchen. And there's the promise that working in the kitchen the correct way will be transformative, and working in the kitchen the incorrect way will just be more hard work and suffering. And so I was working in the kitchen as diligently as I could with a head cook who some of you know named Rick Sloan, wonderful, kind, and compassionate follower of the way. And we had our differences because he was a little bit less rigid than I was about most things. So I had pretty clear ideas about like where we would put the knives and how we would wash the cutting boards and how we would cover our heads with the cloth, and he sort of felt like it'd be good if lunch is more or less on time, but it's okay. So this was already the dynamic that me and Rick had, the kind of push and pull of, you could say, rigidity and laxity. And then this thing happened called September 11th, 2001. Remember some some buildings fell down, and some people were really hurt and died. And then there was a lot of fear and distress and panic and awareness of the depth of the suffering in the world. And Rick really took it on really fully. He really felt that suffering at that time. And he thought that he really felt called to do his part to heal the world. Felt like in this time of division and hatred, we need to build some bridges. We need to do something to heal the world. And so he threw himself into this project that he was doing with some friends in the interfaith community of building bridges across especially these religious lines. And I, meanwhile, was still very interested in correct kitchen practice. I also was disturbed by the crisis, but I was as committed as ever to just diligent kitchen practice in the right way and not the wrong way. So I remember going into his office at some point in the days, one or two days after September 11th, and he was working on this project, this world-saving project that he had cooked up with a friend. And I went into his office to register my objection to some of my fellow kitchen workers not non-wearing of the mandated head cover for kitchen work. This is our practice, to cover our hair when we work in the kitchen, and they're not doing it. And you're in charge of the kitchen. You should be out there telling them they have to do it. So I think we both got a little bit upset. And if I recall, he pointed out that I was narrow-minded and uptight and judgmental. And I think I probably pointed out that he was abdicating his duties as a priest and Tenzo. I think it went something like that. And I returned to the kitchen and he returned to saving the world. And I don't remember if the people were made to wear their headscarves or not. But you know, as community life so wonderfully does, we had to continue together, so we had to find some way through. So a couple days later, he engaged me about this incident, this argument that we had had, and he summarized our positions, I think, in a really nice way. Particularly reflected against the anxiety and concern and fear that we were all feeling at that time. He said, Rick's feeling was that with the world in the state it's in, how can you be worried about covering your head in the kitchen? There are like some bigger things to worry about than like maybe a little tiny hair is going to get into somebody's soup, you know? And it's a really good point. We're so focused on the minutia, not to mention the element of judging each other. You know, he walked in with the wrong foot at the zendo. Especially in temple life, you know, how exactly should your thumbs be in the gassho? Why not use our bandwidth? Why not turn our energy to the actual questions, the actual challenges that our human family is facing now? Why not do something about this deep division and suffering in the world? Because that is the Bodhisattva path, the Bodhisattva call to ease suffering in whatever ways we can. So why would I be so petty? And I hear that and feel that even now. And then he summarized what he felt like I had been saying. So he said, so my feeling was that with the world and the state, how can you worry about covering your head in the kitchen? Who cares? But I think what you were feeling was that given the state of the world, isn't covering our heads the very least we could do? And I really appreciated that reflection. You know, given the suffering of the world, isn't taking care of this detail that's right in front of me now the very least I can do for that suffering? And in a sense, the louder, the more acute, the more I allow myself to be penetrated by the depth of the suffering of the world, then even more the stakes for my engagement with each detail in front of me, right? It's the least we can do for this broken world is like put the chopstick where the chopstick goes. And this, you know, is very much the feeling of Zen practice in its emphasis on detail. We can talk about taking care of the whole world. And miss the actual world that we have to take care of right in front of us. You know, this warm-hearted, diligent, thorough caring for even the smallest thing is they say, the wind of the house of Soto Zen. It's the family style, is to take really good care of chopsticks. So, you know, Rick and I were both, as you are here, steeped in and studying this teaching of non-separation, of interdependence, of our relatedness, the total relatedness of each and every thing. This is the hallmark of Buddhist teaching. When we look for something, we try to get our minds or our arms around something, we really look into something, all we see is everything else. All we see is the relationships that make that up. There's lots of ways to talk about this. The most basic is that nothing is here that doesn't depend on something else. And there's a lot of teachings, ways of talking through the centuries and through the Buddhist traditions that support, that illuminate this teaching. And I brought some of them in order to prove to you that this really is the teaching of the Buddha, but I maybe don't need to prove to you that this is the teaching of the Buddha, because you can maybe just notice right now that there is nothing happening that is unrelated. Find that part of this moment that's unrelated to something else. Is there anything here that's out of relationship? Any part of my own body or mind or heart that's not in relationship? I thought I found something, but then I looked into it a little bit and I saw that it wouldn't have been there without some other thing. It's in relationship. And nothing exists by itself. One of my favorite expressions of this is a Zen koan, very much captures my own glimpse at this interdependence. There's an old koan that says, asks the question, it says, why can't the man of great strength raise his leg? He's so strong. He's like the strongest. But why can't he raise his own leg? Why can't the man of great strength raise his leg? You can try it. You know, you might think you're really good at raising your arm or raising your leg, but you can't do that by yourself. You can't do that from your own power. You can't do that outside of relationship. If you're raising your arm, it's a relationship. It is the relationship of everything coming together to create person with arm raising. Does that speak to your experience? I have no power outside of these relationships, and I have no self apart from these relationships. So nothing is isolated. Nothing is at any remove from really anything else. Everything in the totality of being works together to condition the situation in which a person is lifting their arm or their leg. So the world is a much more intimate place than we imagine it. This teaching of no self, of non-separation, is a teaching of intimacy. Intimacy in our own body. You know, even our own body moving is intimate with everything. It's not done by ourselves. So it's lovely to see this connection, to see this relatedness. You know, understand how we really are in each other's lives. We are each other's lives. One of my favorite teachings is the teaching of no connection. There's no connection. It's actually so intimate that even to say that we're in each other's lives is like not intimate enough. Because if it's me and you and our lives are intimate, there's still some line between the two. You know, the project of the great ancestor Nagarjuna is to say, well, look at these two things. You think there's some, these two things are intimate. These two things are interacting, like the seed and the flower. They're interacting, right? The one is the kind of, but they're interacting so deeply that you actually can't find where the one would end. You can't find a line in this intimacy behind which on one side is me and on the other side is you, you know? On one side is the soil and on the other side is the flower. It's more intimate than that. So we say no connection. Because connection needs, like, isolation. Isolated things can be connected. And then it's just like a little connection. Like mostly, I'm 98% isolated, but you know, it's like the ET thing, the fingers touch, and now we're connected. But like, I'm still over here and ET's still over there, but now we have a little point of contact. It's not like that. It's like, we are totally non-separate. We're not a little bit connected. So we just say, no, forget connection. There's no connection. It's one piece. This is very much the Huayan teaching of totality. There's one piece going on, and this one piece has exactly everything that's here now. Which means that everything that's here now exactly is required for that one piece, and nothing that's happening here now could happen without any other piece of this whole thing happening. I often talk about this as life is a package deal. It's like you don't get the package and say, oh, I really want those, like, the black socks, but I don't want the blue socks. You don't have that option. It's a package. If you're getting any socks, you're getting the black socks and the blue socks and the red socks. Do you know what I mean? You don't say like, oh, I could still have some socks that I would get to pick. It's one thing. It's a totality. You get either no world or you get a totality world that has every single piece functioning in total intimacy. And we need to see this. The Buddha's teaching is that it's really good to see this. We really should try to see this. And we can talk ourselves into it. We can meditate ourselves into it. We can walk our way into it. But we need to understand that we have no life at all apart from each and everything. And that each and everything has no life at all apart from each and every particle and each and every action of ourselves. Total intimate totality. So seeing this no connection, seeing this non-separation or interdependence is great. It's important. In its most dramatic forms, we call it kensho. It's like awakening. It's awesome. You should do it. But in Sotō Zen, we talk about another dimension too, which is called enacting it. We take this vow to enact this intimacy, this interdependence, this deep need for each other, this no connection. We vow to enact it however, whenever we possibly can. So this enactment piece is at really the core of Sotō Zen teaching, at least. In Sotō Zen we say, it's good to see it. It's fine to see it. We're happy for you that you saw it. And people would tell about how lovely it was to see that, oh, that, you know, I am the leaf and the leaf is me. Hooray, you saw it. In Zen we say, can you do it? It's great that you saw it, but can you do it? So we talk about enactment. There's a kind of, there are limits to the seeing it or the understanding it. You know, for one, our conscious mind, our conscious experience is never actually going to capture this intimacy. Why? Because our conscious mind is structured to see things. Our conscious mind is structured to see single things, like a candle and a candle flame and an altar and a bunch of flowers. We see a single thing and we conceptualize in single things. That's how our cognitive capacities go. But there are no single things. So our consciousness is never going to encompass this totality, because our consciousness is always dividing into things. That's how it's structured. That's how it works. So for one, our consciousness is never really going to fully understand this, the depth of our intimacy with each other. Secondly, our seeing of it is impermanent. Yesterday I saw it. Today I don't see it. I hope tomorrow I see it. I didn't see it tomorrow. Maybe next week I'll see it. It's impermanent. It doesn't last. So it becomes this object of attachment. Maybe I'll see it again. I want to see it again. Give it to me again. How come you said that if I did a sashin, I would see it. I did sashin, I saw it, but now I did another sashin and I didn't see it. What's going on? I want a refund. Our consciousness doesn't capture it. And even if it does, that's just for a moment. That's just as long as whatever glimpse we have of it is just based on conditions. Remember? Just happened to be that way, as Uchiyama Roshi says, you feel enlightened? That's just the weather. It was like a nice day, so everybody saw interdependence. Because the breeze was just right and the temperature, and you just feel the breeze moving right through you and you feel that you are the breeze. And so it was just a nice day. And so you had that feeling. It's impermanent. And then the third is that, what does that do for your friends, you know? Often what it does is, I saw interdependence and you didn't. You'd come to Kokyo's place and with me, you know, so you can see it like I do. And then you can be kind of a better person than you are currently. So what helps, you know? Does the seeing help? Maybe it does, but it doesn't necessarily. Seeing this doesn't necessarily help. The teaching of doing it, I think, invites a whole different capacity, a whole different sensibility. Some days you see it, some days you don't see it. Whether you see it or not, to whatever extent you see it or not, can you do it? Can you enact this interdependence? Can you enact this non-separation? So I don't know how non-separation is being talked about. Here I hear there's some conversation about it. It's good to realize. It's good to notice. It's also something to do. You know, there's this idea that Zen is like a verb, right? Our practice is a verb. We do non-separation. We don't receive it. It's something we do. In our activity. And so how do we do it? What do we do that does interconnection? How do we enact this in the world? We also use this language of confirmation or enactment, actualization, realization, proving, making real, you know, may my life prove the intimacy of all beings. May my actions confirm intimacy with all beings. You know, confirm it for myself and confirm it to the Buddhas and confirm it to everyone else. So I feel like that vow really was shared by Rick and I. We were both trying sincerely to do interdependence, to do relatedness with the suffering world. And for him it meant found a nonprofit organization. And for me it meant tie the headscarf correctly in the Soto Zen temple, you know? Understand that everything is of consequence in this network of interdependence, in this network of relatedness, in this totality, everything is of consequence. That's the first most basic teaching on interconnection, is the Buddha saying, hey, everything you do matters way more than you know. Actually, only I, the Buddha, really know how much that matters, every tiny thing. No, please, take my word for it, it really matters. So, how will we do this? You know, what will we do to enact, moment after moment, in ways big and small, this relatedness, this intimacy with the world? So I don't know. Maybe it's getting the temple forms just right as an enactment. I want to prove that we're intimate, and I want to prove that by handing you the incense just right, you know? And I want to prove that by sweeping. Or it may be these big picture, world-saving ventures that sprout and fall like flowers. But what will I do, and what will you do to enact, to make real this intimacy that we have? Or maybe better, maybe more to the point is, how will I do this enacting? You know, I think both sides are important. First, what will I do? What will I do to make this intimacy real? We say things like, well, I'm going to stop killing. I'm going to stop lying and stealing. Those would be some good things, you know, of like what I'm going to do to make this intimacy real. But there's also this teaching of just how, this question of how will I do whatever I do, how will I do it in a way that celebrates, confirms, actualizes intimacy. I'm not going to wait until I figure out the thing to do. Like, well, while the papers for my nonprofit are still being processed by the IRS, I'm like, hold off. Like, every step doing how I do something. And often we're not in control of the what we're doing a lot of the time. A very small window of time, if ever, are we actually in control of what we do. We have the feeling that we're a little more in control of how we do something. And we could question that too, if you want to go there. That's not exactly in our control either. But still, we have this sincerity, we have this feeling that we can focus on how we do each thing. And then still ask, what am I going to do? But not neglect how, in this moment, can I hear the suffering, feel the suffering of the world, and let that inspire me to see that this moment, this action is of consequence. This moment, this action is a chance to celebrate my intimate relatedness, our total relatedness with one another, and to make that real. That's this kind of religious teaching of Soto Zen, is like, that's not real until you do it. As soon as you do it, that intimacy is real. But you have to do it. Don't just sit back. So just one more point, and then I want to stop talking as ongoing enactment, as clearer enactment of my vow to help. you know, one side, as I said, this relatedness is the same teaching as the teaching of emptiness. So if we say things are empty, things are empty. What are they empty of? They're empty of being separate. They're empty of being unrelated. There's nothing that's not related, which is to say it's empty of being itself. It's empty of being non-related. So this teaching of emptiness, there's this beautiful intersection of the teaching of emptiness and the teaching of relation. It's the same teaching. But for me, the teaching of emptiness is about freedom. The teaching of emptiness, there's many ways to talk about it, but to me it means, hey, every single thing you think is not true, including that. Every single thing you think doesn't actually correlate. Because everything you think is a thing, and there's no things out there. All of my views, and I have so many of them, and a lot of them are tied up in what I'm going to do to be interdependent. It's all views, and none of it touches the reality of life. To be totally free from everything I think, you know? What a relief, they say. It's like the whinny of a pack horse unloaded of everything. I'm just so used to carrying this stuff around. We just unload it all, or the bottom of the bucket drops out. What a relief, you know, to not have to believe anything that this guy is producing anymore. So that freedom of emptiness, none of my views have any traction. That's this invitation to just really release all of the ways I see the world. Know that none of them reach. So that's one side, and that's freedom, and that's equanimity. That's like, wow, I have a view that I am suffering, and that I am experiencing great loss, and that I'm experiencing great pain, and that our planet is dying, and that everyone I love will die, and to have all of that with the composure of, and, not exactly. that's my view, that's a view, yeah, that's how I see it, but there's this freedom and equanimity and composure born of this understanding of emptiness, this appreciation of emptiness. But again, this emptiness is just the relation. So the relation side calls us in to engage, to enact, to prove, to do. But it's the same teaching. So the same teaching that I feel can free me from all of my views also invites me into this acting of relatedness. And I'm finding, feeling and hearing a real call to live right at that intersection where nothing I believe is true, nothing I believe is false, but not caught by any views, and yet totally committed to enacting my interdependence in whatever way I can come up with. You know? So to feel the call into the world of relatedness, and also to be free from all of the ways that we see that, feels like a truly dharmic way of being active in the world. Totally active in proving relatedness and then totally free of all our views of how that would unfold. Are there any comments or questions or objections, especially? I'm very used to hearing objections.
Mm-hmm. This reminds me of the end of the Gendro poem, the nature of the discarnate, and as it does not reach, why then do you ban yourself?
Yes.
And then it goes, you don't understand the meaning of it's reaching everywhere, and then it keeps banning himself. And I don't know if I like the word doing so much as being, though, because like I don't think you would fan yourself in a hurricane or if there's a strong breeze, but if there isn't a breeze, then yeah. There's still
wind.
Does that make sense?
It's taking me a second. I've never had the hurricane in my image of that line, so I'm reorienting my deeply fixed view of that line to include a hurricane. take cover.
Himself in a strong wind.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, I'd say take cover. Yeah. how to this the truth of relatedness is true. It's true that this relatedness is true. But it's not true in the absence of our enacting it. It's true as we enact it. And in this way, our enactment is needed for its truth. Its truth isn't separate from our enactment of it. And it's not a, it's not a robotic fanning. It's a responsive winding, you know? It's a responsive proving. So I don't know. Depends on the hurricane, depends on the situation, but the sense of it's not just, oh, they said fan, so it's like, you can stop fanning now, the situation has changed. But there is still, something needs to be brought forth. We don't say, because there's already awakening, because there's already the total intimacy of all beings, why should I have to act intimate with all beings? There already is the intimacy of all beings, I shouldn't have to like, be intimate. It just is the fact of things. No, it's not quite. That's not quite it. It's not the fact of things until you do it. And then it's the fact of things. And if you don't understand that your doing is part of that truth, then you understand neither permanence nor the nature of wind. Yeah. Thank you for that. Enactment. Teaching very strong in Dogen's. Yeah.
So the teaching that all things exist by relations is a wonderful teaching. Do you think Zen would go so far as to say that the things are imagined and only the relations are true?
Definitely. Certainly that the things, wouldn't say that they're imagined, but the things are... The things can't be discerned, you know, the things can't be picked out. And when we see things, we cut off relatedness, you know? To see a thing, we kind of carve it out from the relationship to see what it is. Yeah, and but you can't do that. You can't, that kills it, you know? It's then, as soon as you carve it out, it's not there anymore. Whether the relations are imaginary in the sense that what relation is there between things that weren't there to begin with? Is could say inconceivable totality. So what? Now relatedness is a thing. So this comes up in Nagarjuna as well. Say, oh, okay, everything's related. So you say relatedness is a real thing? No! Relatedness is just related to isolation. Relatedness isn't really how things are. Relatedness is related to isolation. You know? That doesn't exist either. That's not unrelated. It's not the actual essence. Yeah. Yeah.
And I often feel like it's really important to kind of just step aside.
Yeah.
Like your body, you know the breathing just functions.
Yes.
As long as you don't interfere, all the cells communicate and work together in this beautiful way as long. Mm. So then acting also can be sort of adding something extra.
Yep.
And I totally share that point of view at the same time.
Yep. Thank you. Also often not acting is also adding something extra. Like, I could help, that'd be scary to go ask that person how they are. And anyway, you don't have to do anything. You just live your life, you know. You just are lived. So the natural life that's arising in me just is not going to talk to that person, ask them how they are, that's all. No, nothing is doing, that's a lot of doing. Is it pressure? You know, I think there's a lot to say in the Buddha Dharma about the relationship between effort and non-effort. This idea that we just go with the flow is not quite it, you know? So in a way, there's this way of talking about Buddhism, it's lovely teaching by a scholar who says, you know, Buddhism is taught so much in the West as stress reduction. Buddhism will relieve your stress. He says, actual traditional Buddhism is more like stress induction. It produces stress. You are going to die. Everyone you love is going to die very soon. Chances are, after this life, you're going to live for a billion eons in some mode that doesn't even let you glimpse the possibility of getting off of the wheel of suffering. Nothing you care about has any value. It's stress-inducing. So there is pressure, you know. There is pressure in the way. And I think that's a really interesting question. How does the pressure, where is the pressure? I've been thinking about this because it's easy to be strict in the wrong way. So like, I think when I was describing the kind of caricature of myself as a young monk, I was very strict, but not in the right way. I was being strict, feeling pressure to do something, but the thing I was feeling pressure to do was like tie the knot correctly, you know? It's like a lot of pressure towards not quite the right thing. What about a lot of pressure towards like, now, you know? How about like, no, this is really important. I really feel under a lot of pressure to like stop grasping in this moment, you know? I really feel that what's at stake in my presence now, you know? And that I really feel this vow and this call to be intimate and be, stop holding back my intimacy and to fully enact it with all things. Like, I can feel that weight, you know, it's interesting, I don't like to talk about it that way, because I'm committed to relaxation, and for a lot of us it's vital medicine, you know. So to be able to just sit and let everything go is a beautiful gift we can give to ourselves and each other. But taking up this vow, also, there's some weight, you know. And so do we turn away from that weight? There's a way I want to live. And so it doesn't need to have, that's where the emptiness medicine, you know? I think that's why I'm appreciating this intersection, where if I start to drift too far into should, enact, you know, whatever that even means, there's exactly that voice. What does that even mean, you know? Just come back. So, but I appreciate that. How do we encourage ourselves just enough and encourage ourselves not to get stressed out about practice on our to-do list or something, or like, you know, clean the house, enact interdependence with all beings, buy toilet paper. It's just when we remember, really, really driving ourselves to remember that we want to do it right now, that we want to live in an intimate way. Part of the emptiness side for me is then no gain about how that's going to look or what that's going to do. I think part of the pressure is like, and then I'm going to check at the end of the day, and if the world's not a better place, then like I've reduced suffering by 0.2%, you know? So that part of the gaining sense of it. So this enactment in its purest form is just to enact it, that's all. So the being is still suffering, and I'm still suffering, that's fine. The world is still totally broken. The planet is still like mostly dead. Fine. It wasn't about stopping all of that. It was just about enacting this thing, you know. So somehow, the pressure isn't a problem if it's going the right way, you know. The pressure, it's like when the pressure's a little bit off. That's my experience. The weight versus the motivation, the way-seeking mind. When the push is right at the right spot, where, all right, there is pressure, but it's the pressure of the vow, you know. Through an open channel. Rather than pressure on some blocked channel, if that image makes any sense. There's also some plumbers in there.
Liz. And how you started talking about suffering and and just how the mind tries so hard to grasp what is going on with the quantity, the volume of suffering, and we can never really understand it, and it doesn't feel good to step back. But it's funny. We can start off hearing a lot about the world, and wake up to being, and then I think just kind of like the weather changes, and that question comes up again: suffering. What about suffering? And maybe we're just struck by it. Yeah, how we can wake up, or we can go back to sleep. Yeah. Never really, with our mental capacity, get a handle on it.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm feeling like what I want to do, and part of why I want to keep the suffering close, which isn't so easy for me. Like, I would rather not keep the suffering close. But I see this possibility of letting that suffering, because of all of the intensity of that, and the helplessness and the despair and the sadness and all of that. But I'm having this image, this vision, this appreciation for, like, harnessing that into enactment now, you know? The sense of, like, what if I actually open further to the suffering of the world, and then let that pain inspire me to more diligently enact relatedness now, here, you know? So the usual thing is, then I hear the suffering and then I'm overwhelmed because, oh my gosh, I have to go to like Syria and like help a kid or something. Like, I don't have time to go to Syria. Like, I can barely help my own kids, you know? And so that kind of overwhelm and that despair. And then it's just like, forget it. I can't hear about it because it's not going to, I don't know what to do with it. And now I feel like, well, wait, I do know what to do with it. Actually, I can open to it and feel that anguish and then say, and I have a way of, that just means I'm more gentle today. I am like stepping as an enactment of relatedness from the cries of the world. You know what I mean? And then suddenly this thing that's been just like dragging me down and overwhelming me is like harnessed to the way, you know? Is like reminding me that there's really something at stake in my practice. Like, actually, how I do this now, it's the least I can do. When if no suffering is in my mind, it's kind of like, well, whatever, it's chopstick. If the suffering is on my mind and in my heart, then it's like, wow, the least I can do is take care of this moment, you know, and enact this relatedness with who's ever in front of me. And then maybe I have time to go somewhere or not, whatever. It's just that is using it, you know, using that, which is part of why I feel so called and inspired by this, like turning towards the world as a Dharma gate. I feel like there's power there, there's energy there. And how can we use that for the way, you know, and for the world? So that's my path of practice these days. Maybe resonates with your own path of practice, maybe doesn't. But I really appreciate your patient enactment of relatedness this evening. And oh, how can that suffering right there, implied in that sound, the whole world right there of suffering beings that were absent from this room and now are in this room, oh, what's the least I can do? No. The least I can do is appreciate this breath. The least I can do is dedicate the merit of this talk, dedicate the merit of our practice tonight and all our practices to the liberation and ease and freedom from suffering of all sentient beings. Thank you so much, and thanks again, Kokil, for the invitation.
Beings are numberless, I vow to save them.